You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and the other person on that screen that is not me is Dr. Greta Euling, Professor Greta Euling, Michigan, yes? University yes. of Michigan. And thank you. Thank you for being here and being willing to speak about your work. Your work generally and quite specifically, and the occasion for this conversation actually is the publication of her book, which is called Decolonizing Ukraine. It has a longer title, so you should say it.
The Indigenous People and Pathways to Freedom.
Thank you. And you have been looking at, you are a cultural anthropologist by training and vocation, and so two things. Briefly say what that means for people who may or may not know, and then we'll go from there. Actually, that was one thing.
Okay. So cultural anthropologists study living people. And the methodology is something that I really treasure because it involves becoming really just involved in a community and learning experientially by going through people's daily struggles with them and talking with them and doing all the things that they're doing. And so it really generates deep insights that you might not obtain from, you know, a 5 or 10 minute conversation, like is customarily the methodology with journalism.
And you have been looking at, immersed in that part of the world, Ukraine, and that area for. I don't understand how you do it. You're 32 and you've been there for 30 years. Oh, that's amazing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good trick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is a long time. And so what drew you there? How did you get there?
Well, it seems like a long time, but that goes back to the methodology, right? Like once you're deeply connected to a community, it doesn't seem like a long time. It's not boring. It's part of your life. It shifts your priorities. It shifts what you're thinking about. And so I became interested in the Crimean Tatars, the largest indigenous group in Ukraine, because their story is so extraordinary and nobody knew it. Nobody knew it, right? Like here is a group of people who had a fully established state, lasted for 300 years, comprised over 90% of the population of Crimea. They're deported. Their population in Crimea goes down to zero. Because there is this effort to erase them. There's many parallels between like their experience and the native population in the United States. They're deported, but they survive. How do they survive? They're told they can't even say their name. How do they remember it? How do they preserve their culture? And 50 years pass, they repatriate themselves. They're still not welcome. They survive that too. How? Right? And I wanted to know. And so my first book was about beyond memory, and it was about how they preserved their history through an oral tradition that gave them the kind of cultural continuity and awareness that inspired their repatriation. But this, you know, this latest book, Decolonizing Ukraine, like right now the world is very focused on the latest negotiations, right, in ending the war on Ukraine. And what this book tries to do is go back to the very beginning and uncover the root causes. And I find the root causes in an attitude, right? A set of beliefs that is essentially territory is there for the taking, right? Will of, you know, the might makes, you know, the most, the mightiest are the greatest, that kind of mentality. And that has been the story of Crimea for a very long time. And so, you know, beginning with the 2014 occupation of Crimea by Russian Federation, you know, at that point, I go back. And as a Fulbright scholar in Ukraine over a three-year period, I carried out a lot of interviews. I spoke to people who stayed in Crimea. I spoke to people who fled Crimea to understand the experience of occupation and what follows.
Were you interested in indigenous cultures prior to getting there? Do you have a sense about why that drew your passion? I want to look at this. And, you know, I mean, that area of the world, there's plenty of indigenous people closer to home, right? So there was something that put you there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, so what put me in Ukraine was, you know, I went there for the first time on an exchange program. I was very curious why the Russians and the Ukrainians in my midst didn't get along or respect one another. That was a puzzle when I first got to Western Ukraine. And as I studied the history of the region, I began to understand more and more how Russia and Russians in Ukraine had sort of made a practice of looking down upon Ukrainians as like lesser versions of themselves, to which the Ukrainians did not respond favorably, understandably, right? Sure. They wanted to be out from under that thumb.
Right.
And so in the process of doing that research in Ukraine, I then came across the Crimean Tatars, who were not only under Russians, but Ukrainians, right? Like there's sort of like a double oppression going on. And that is a central point in the new book, Decolonizing Ukraine, because Ukraine is in this process of like not only disentangling itself from Russian influence, but also really interrogating its treatment of its own indigenous peoples, which has not until very, very recently been good, right? And so it's a big part of the book is looking at the success they've had actually in turning around like essentially a multi-century pattern of discrimination against the indigenous population, right? So since the occupation of Crimea by Russia, Zelensky has done things like pronounce that 1944 deportation a genocide, declare them to be the indigenous people, set up a permanent representative to Crimea, create a platform for dialogue, right? There's a number of really forward-thinking initiatives, and this is one way in which Ukraine is actually exemplary, right? Yeah. Turning around that history. I mean, I think they've done things the United States has not,
right? Mm-hmm. Right, and you know, I don't want to be cynical. Maybe I am cynical, but I'm not. But do you get a sense? Are you in a position to opine about whether or not the actions by Ukraine toward the Tartars are because it's strategically wise at the moment, or is this a genuine, you know, they've suddenly realized, or they're suddenly realizing, God, we were kind of assholes. Like, or is it strategically, this is, we need a foot permanently in the door of Crimea. So the world, which seems to have sort of come to some bizarre conclusion that, well, that's done and done, right? Russia took over. So that's there, you know, that's theirs now.
Uh-huh.
And that's something Ukraine wants. But You get a sense that it grows out of this, the tragedy that's going on there now, the invasion by Russia, or is this really like, what were we thinking? That was terrible.
It's a really important question. And it's a question that I do answer in the book. And what my research shows is that while there may be practical or strategic reasons why Ukraine would alter its treatment of the indigenous people, I would grant you that straight off the bat. What the book traces is really a process of social cohesion, the building of social cohesion in Ukraine that really comes down to, you know, there was a revolution there in 2013 to 2014. And at that time, Ukrainians of all different backgrounds started to really rethink what it meant to be Ukrainian. And the national idea or the national identity that emerged from that crucible of revolution and change of authorities and upheaval was that it's not linked to ethnicity or religion or whiteness or your personal identity as much as it's linked to values. And that is what has brought Ukrainians of all different backgrounds together, right? Is this idea that what holds us together is the value we place on freedom. And the value we place on freedom is also what distinguishes us from Russia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the Tartars agree with that.
Totally. I mean, they always have. They always have. And I think that the reason that there wasn't a closer alliance like between Crimean Tatars and other Ukrainians in the past was partly because, you know, Crimea is kind of like this little island in the Black Sea, right? It's a peninsula, yeah, only loosely connected to the mainland. And many Ukrainians never had reason to go there, and many, you know, Crimean Tatars didn't go to Ukraine. And so the groups were geographically separated. They were also separated by a very powerful strain in Russian historiography that depicted them at least as mortal enemies, arch enemies over the centuries, right? And so that was kind of the stereotype that popped out of Ukrainian children's history books and was reinforced in film and art. Was this idea that they were these wild, you know, marauding on horseback and taking off people's heads and destroying churches, right? Like that was the story that was propagated by Russian historiography. And a big part of what decolonizing Ukraine means is both like grieving their mutual oppression under Russia. That's number one, recognizing that they have common losses as a result of this history. But also really reevaluating their history, diving deeper into it and rethinking certain aspects of it and making incredible discoveries. Like my friend Julia was talking about how they had these melodies and they thought that they were like their traditional melody. And then after they fled to the continental part of Ukraine, they realized that Ukrainians had the same melody in Ukrainian. And then they realized they had similar practices around like marriage and visiting and births, like similar social practices. So they had a lot in common, and it really took revolution followed by all of that population displacement to rediscover that.
So just so I have my history somewhat straight. So in the 40s, 44, the Stalin kicked out the Tartars, right? Mm-hmm. Moved them elsewhere.
Yes.
And so they were displaced. They then had the opportunity to come back when the Soviet Union was disbanding?
Basically, yes. They were no longer prevented,
right,
but they also weren't really aided in that process. So right. Yes. Okay. So
then they came back. Mm-hmm. And or at least that some people came back. So the population, the Tartar population in Crimea at the moment is large?
It's between 12 and 13% of the population as a whole.
Of the population of Crimea or Ukraine?
Crimea. Crimea, yeah.
And then
yeah.
The Russians come back in and claim it, as it's always been ours, right? Blah, blah, blah. But they're not displaced. They're not kicked out, or are they? But they're living in an occupied world. They're living under whatever Russian occupation looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does Rock, do you have a, Are you able to be in that region? Were you able to be in that region? And like, what does occupation look like for the Tartars who are currently in Crimea?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, when Russia occupied Crimea in 2014, they did exile intellectuals and political leaders. They wanted to decapitate the community. So the top leaders were prevented from living there. They also persecuted, you know, journalists, academics, activists, artists, essentially anybody who protested against the Russian occupation. Life was made extremely difficult. In many cases, they were arrested and imprisoned. So there are, you know, close to 200 politically motivated prisoners and over half of them are Crimean Tatar. Even their population of the peninsula is only between 12 and 13%. So
they
were targeted for arrest and imprisonment. There was also disappearances. People are tortured. They're followed. And so what life looks like is for the Crimean Tatars who are there now is that they're maintaining their culture, as a way to survive this phase of their history. Some of them continue to be activists. Some of them just try to keep their head down, focus on, you know, getting to work and back without incident, caring for loved ones. And they told me, I worked with them quite intensively when they were up in continental Ukraine to take care of things, right? Like a birth certificate or a diploma or something sort of administrative. They were often in continental Ukraine. And so I worked with them quite intensively. And what they said was, whether you flee or you stay, everybody has to make the decision for themselves based on their safety. And we decided to stay because that is the only way to preserve a path to the future that we want, right? Like if everybody left, that would just facilitate Putin's project of you know, taking all of Crimea for himself. And so they stay, and they, but also there's some deeper dimensions to that, because we're talking about a group that formed as a group on that territory. And so they think about it in terms of, this is where the graves of our ancestors are,
right,
going back centuries. Right. And this is the homestead or the plot of land or the house that our parents and our grandparents had to really fight to gain back when right. they repatriated, you know, after the disintegration of the Soviet Union in the early 90s. And so it's really a big part of Crimean Tatar culture is like honoring your family, honoring elders, honoring ancestors. And so they stay for that.
As my ignorance is about to shine brightly, unless it already has, but so in the United States, it was often the case and still is that, you know, walking down the street, you know, walking down the street in rural Alabama, right, there were white people and then there were black people, and they were easily identified. And when somebody wanted to, when somebody had a feeling about black people, it was hard to hide. And true for Native Americans in the United States, is this, you had used the word whiteness before. Are, like, walking down the street, would somebody be able to recognize, this is a Tartar, and that's a Russian, or that's a Ukrainian? Do people stand out like that? Or, you know, would you be hard pressed, you know, which one of these is not like the other?
Some of them are visually distinguishable. Some of them are not, because they have this genetic makeup that's very diverse, because, you know, the way Crimea was settled over the centuries was invaders from the north, seamen from the south, all of these groups mix and combine. And so, like, we'd say that, like, the physical appearance of Crimean Tatars, some of them appear, appear sort of like Turkic looking. So olive complexion, brown hair, green eyes. Some of them are a little bit more Asian looking. Some of them are a combination. And some of them are like, I could, if I had dark hair, I would pass for Crimean Tatar, right? Because of my facial features. So some of them are not distinguishable, but you raise a really important point that I think is important for understanding the Ukraine's treatment of its indigenous people, which is that so throughout this period of, you know, Russia sort of dominating Ukraine, it still sees Ukraine as, like, it uses this term little brother, or they're like the little Russians. They're like us, and they just need to remember that they are us. Right, that's the Russian-Ukrainian relationship.
Yeah.
Now, if we bring in the Crimean Tatars to that, they're always like orientalized, essentialized as these exotic others who are inherently more violent, inherently less civilized, inherently prone to you know, destructive behavior. And so their treatment historically has always been dramatically worse, both from Ukrainians and from Russians, right? And so there is a racial element to all of this. And I think that there too, you know, I really take inspiration from the American civil rights movement because of the deep insights it contains about, You know, if you're looking at another person and you see them as less than, somehow less than you, that's your problem, right? It doesn't, it's not that person's problem. I mean, obviously they have to deal with it, but the project of Ukraine, like fully liberating itself from Russian domination, means that they also have to grapple with the extent to which they have treated Crimean Tatars like blacks, basically.
Yes.
Right? They have to grapple with that history.
Right.
And they're doing a great job. My point is that it's not over until Ukraine, it's not enough to repel Russian aggression. They also have to work with their own internal dynamics.
Is that last statement made from, I was about to say something that's knowing how you do what you do and how you do what you do is sort of, it's completely incorrect, but is that statement made from a distance that this is what they have to do? Or, is it an active, do you get a sense that it's an active effort? I mean, here you are fighting for survival because the Russians are doing what the Russians are doing. And at the same time, you have to be careful to, like, you know, how you speak about those other people, those other people that have been mistreated for years. Are you saying that it behooves them to do that? Or are they sort of eagerly and actively welcoming that challenge? It really comes from some realization that, you know, to say it in some way that is less academic, we fucked up for all those years and we got to stop being that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that, it would be foolish to try to generalize and say all Ukrainians dot dot.
Sure.
Right. And so if we look at the level of the presidential administration, they came to the realization that this group that had been terribly mistreated, you know, that had to be rectified. And I think it was very, very genuine. And I think it's also genuine on the part of many, many, many Ukrainians. And so I'll tell you a couple stories. Like, this is something that I live. Like, right, I lived it. So in continental Ukraine, I'm sitting at my friend's kitchen table. Her neighbor, who happens to be Ukrainian, comes over. We get to talking, you know, we're having coffee. And this Ukrainian neighbor did not know that the Crimean Tatars had been deported in 1944. She didn't know that. Yeah. And when she heard the story, she wept and wept and wept because it was through this neighbor relationship, this friendship that enabled her to see that, you know, she didn't have the full story. So that's one story. And then these two women became the fastest of friends, right? And new friendships were among the things that people most welcomed when they left Crimea and ended up in, you know, they fled the occupation and ended up in continental Ukraine. That was sort of like the best part of it, was forming new friendships and realizing that they could play a really important role in just sharing their history with Ukrainians that would not have, that either never knew or, you know, some at some point heard about it but didn't remember. So that's one story. And then another story comes from the occupied part of Ukraine, Crimea. My friend Anna was in her driveway and her neighbor was out, and You know, in the previous days, there had been a number of disappearances, and people were really on edge because it's the young men. You know, like basically what happens is there's a raid on the house, they take the electronics, and then the adult head of household is taken off in a van, sometimes to prison, sometimes he comes back, right? How it ends. And so everybody was on edge. And her neighbor, Sasha, said, "Don't worry, you know, if it gets any worse, I'll hide you in my house. I'll hide you." And I think that that statement, and she said, "Why would I hide in your home? I'm home. Like, you're on the land of my ancestors." He didn't know that either. So this is in this case, this is a Russian man living in Crimea who has no clue that the Crimean Tatars were once over 90% of the population. Their language is the lingua franca for the entire peninsula. They had a fully developed democratic, it was the first Muslim democracy for over 300 years. And it was only by virtue of, you know, Russian imperial colonization, followed by the Soviet era, followed by, you know, the foibles of the first Ukrainian sort of, you know, Ukrainian independence. There was a lot to be done there, and they didn't really get to Crimea. So he had no real awareness, right? And that's kind of like what I try to get at in the book, is that like the process of disentangling oneself from Russian domination isn't really about like the road signs or the historical documents as much as it is about education and opening up your mind to think differently.
It's really, it's astonishing, and which is why I suppose the move at first is you get rid of the intellectuals, you get rid of the teachers, you get rid of the journalists, you get rid of the people who have this problem. They want to tell the story. They want people to remember the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I guess as human beings, you know, we have this tendency towards just homeostasis, right? We want to just keep things normal. And so maybe we don't pay attention to everything that we should pay attention to. But, you know, you're noting this parallel of, you know, between the way that Russia operates and the way that the United States has operated. And I think one of the really, you know, there's this whole language for how Russia operates. And so I think people are very astute about, or I should say that, in the book, I call it like the alchemy of adversity, right? That Crimean Tatars had to become very astute to preserve their identity. Otherwise, they would have disappeared, because there's two other indigenous groups of Crimea, and they number in the hundreds, not the hundreds of thousands, but the hundreds, right? They didn't. And it's by virtue of their strategies, their tactics, their mindset that they've been able to survive. And I think that
what do you attribute that to? That why? I mean, you've spent a lot of time there. You know, a lot of those people. Why? How'd they do that? What? Why did they do that when others could not? Did not?
It seems like a paradox, but I've actually asked people that question, and the answer is usually along the lines of it being a dialectic, in the sense that you're going along something, you know, the authorities knock you down, drag you out, something terrible happens. But guess what? You learn from that, and you further develop a different way of coping with the situation. And if that goes on for long enough, you end up with a lot of different strategies and ways of being in the world that sustain you in a really positive way. I mean, they're some of the most positive, generous people that I've ever had the honor of spending time with, because they've learned, they've used all of these terrible experiences to learn and develop as a people. You know, like if you don't have weapons and you can't use the military, you have to use your mind. It's the only thing left.
But they knew that somehow. Somehow they knew that. And then that's the puzzle, right?
Go ahead, please.
So I did
life histories with people who had been dissidents during the Soviet Union, and talked about them with their, I talked to them about their choice to become activists, their choice to become dissidents, their pathway through the political system, which often included trials and imprisonments. And what I would say to you is that, Russia, the KGB is the, now it's been renamed, but it was the KGB during their time, was famous for using very sophisticated psychological tactics to control people. And they had to get inside that decision cycle and be able to derail it using similar techniques to sort of disarm their interrogators, their torturers. And today, we're in a new era of history. Some people would say that, the current Russian regime in Crimea is worse than the Soviet Union. Basically, I think what's really remarkable is that the Soviet, the way Russia controls people is through getting them to put themselves under surveillance and not speak out and making them afraid. And the Crimean Tatars, because they've had so much experience, have been able to circumvent that fear, which has enabled them to do things like, early in the occupation, they blockaded Crimea. They have developed a lot of different, initiatives for deoccupying Crimea. And, even though Russia is trying to terrorize them, they have courage, right?
I'm assuming you and I are the same, and I don't have any reason to assume that, but so many people that I know, Americans, we move around a lot. It's like, I used to be from here, and then I moved here, and then I moved here, and place is, well, sure, I like this and I don't like that. I really do. I loved living in wherever. But they're all just places. And at least in my experience, I did work with the indigenous folks up in upstate New York. And that wasn't the attitude. If it's superstitious, if it's hocus pocus, if it's whatever, but there is a bond. Bond is even too strong a word. They are from the earth, that earth. They are from that. Their parents are from that. Their grandparents are from that. So the idea of being elsewhere, right? It's important to preserve the connection to this place, because that's who we are, right? I mean, that's not an attitude. I can intellectually say that, But I've never felt that. And I wonder, because I know that the people in upstate New York, the indigenous folks from upstate New York, seem to have that, not everybody, obviously, but that there's something about, well, it's almost like they made a promise to the place. They mm-hmm. made a promise to their ancestors. They made a promise to the place. So of course they would figure out ways to survive there, because what do you mean? How else? This is where we are. This is our place. So I wonder if there's that element makes it with that strong with that strong understanding of life. It's like a superpower.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because, whenever somebody asks me, like, well, why should we worry about the indigenous people? You know, there's such a small percentage of the population of Crimea, and an even smaller percentage of the population of Ukraine. Why should we care? And what I often say is they're the most affected, they're the least protected, and they provide a model for a way to be on this planet in which land is not a resource,
yeah,
but a responsibility. And that's a lesson for the 21st century, which like takes me back to what I was saying about the beginning of our conversation, where, you know, the part of what the war is about is this attitude that it's a resource and you can get more
right
if you just take it.
Right.
But for the indigenous people, land is not a resource, it's a responsibility. And you were talking about, well, maybe bond isn't the right word. A word that I find kind of works for me is it's a relationship. Right. Right. Like, they have a relationship with the earth that's very, very powerful. And they also feel like it is what they are made of. Right. They have this relationship, and that means that they cannot simply disregard that responsibility. Right. I had this conversation with these four young guys. They were like 18 or 19 at the time. They had decided to stay in Crimea. And these are very, you know, these are very young men. And yet they were unequivocal. Basically, they said, we have been dispossessed many times, and we have to figure this out because it is our responsibility. Mm. So we need to study history. We need to figure out how we're going to reclaim what is ours. And it's a commitment, right? Like,
yes, right.
Yeah.
Right. I like that. I like that. It's not a resource, it's a responsibility. That's exactly that piece. That would explain so many things about the, you know, what that, I mean, because it's like, hey, we can give you a place in Hoboken, New Jersey. How about that? And nobody's shooting at you. Nobody's torturing you. Nobody, but it's like, what are you talking about?
So, right.
So I don't have a relationship with Hoboken. I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because once you understand like that piece of it, the war seems, right, like how to resolve this war, you find different answers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, oh yeah, we're just going to move these people over here and those people over there and everything is going to be fine.
There's right? a deal, it's not There's the a deal to be made. There's a deal to be made here. It's not a deal. No.
It's not a deal. No. It's not a deal. It could never be a deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's this is a territory both geographically and culturally that I have so little awareness of. And it's such a fascinating is the wrong word. It feels important. It feels important for this to be known. I couldn't tell you, maybe you could, right? So it feels like knowing this, knowing about this changes the conversation, ought to change the conversation about how to resolve that situation. And
I think it does.
I wonder if it does.
What I would say that, like, okay, so the Crimea should return to Ukraine because it is part of Ukraine's sovereign territory, and the territorial system is how, you know, the countries in the world have agreed that they are going to sustain peace amongst themselves, right? So it's a system, it works, it tends to maintain peace, and that's great. And the moral justification for returning Crimea to Ukraine is the Crimean Tatars, because it is historically their land. And so what it means to be indigenous in this context is to, like, have, you know, continuity with those pre-colonial ancestors, and to be survivors of these historic human rights abuses, right? And so it's kind of like, if you want a answer that provides justice, that's the answer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is to not let war crimes go unpunished, and not let these historic human rights abuses go without redress.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the time, and I'm about to ask you, I know we started a little bit later than, but is there anything that feels important to say before we click off about this situation? And I will magically, the book cover will appear both at the beginning and right now, but because it's got to be, I've read pieces of it that I got from someplace, and it seems fascinating. It seems more fascinating now that I'm speaking to you. So you come with a copy of every book, right? Every book that gets sold, you provide.
Yeah. It can be difficult to get copies, but I want to show people the cover. I guess the cover is going to pop up in a second.
Yeah.
But the cover is kind of like a metaphor for the book as a whole, which is that these are plant motifs that Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars share. Uh-huh. And in the middle is this T, which is the symbol of the Crimean Tatar flag. So it's this idea that when we look at Ukraine, we have to see that there are also indigenous people within it. We have to keep them in our view. So I would say that. And I would say for readers that it's filled with the book is really filled with the stories of people who started out ordinary and lived through world-changing, extraordinary events. And so there's lots of very kind of human experiences that form the backbone of the book.
Mm.
So that will hopefully give your ideas, like your readers, an idea of the sense of, like, what they would encounter in this book, right? Is like people's experience. What was it like to be occupied by Russia? What was it like to flee? What happened when you started meeting other Ukrainians?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true for, I mean, I'm glad you just said that piece. Is that so true for almost everything, right? I mean, hey, I can tell you what a croissant tastes like, and you can read how to make one and all that, but putting it in your mouth is a whole different experience. So,
yeah.
Well, Professor Dr. Greta Yuling, thank you so much, Greta, for being willing to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.